I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to The Functional Nerds, episode 161.
All right. That is Patrick. He is an author, a blogger, and a Hugo-nominated podcaster. You can check out his website, atfmb.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at atfmb.
And since we are recording this before WorldCon, we don't know if it's nominated or winner or anything.
It could be a nominator. Yes, yes. You know, so Patrick is either still drunk from his win, or he is still drunk from his loss. I don't think Patrick really drinks at all. So.
No, and you know it's really funny because DiNardo's going to be there, and John and I we hang out and we have a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Patterson's going to be there. So I mean, there's no telling what will happen. He could spike my drink, and I could wake up in bed with George R. R. Martin. We don't know.
That's my dream. No, I'm so sad I'm not going because like everybody that I like online is going just about.
Can you imagine? I mean, like George R. R. Martin already has a lot of cachet, you know, just from mm-hmm. being himself. But with the beard and everything, there could be a lot of people out there who mistake him for someone from the Robertson clan and think that he's part of Duck Dynasty. He could be getting a lot of Duck Dynasty, you know, cachet and not even realize mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, there was a guy. I'm not bringing this up to name drop because I know you've been making fun of me for this lately. But when I was at Nerdtacular, there was a guy in the front row. I believe it was during Film Sack, which is one of the podcasts that Scott Johnson does. And he kind of looked like George R. R. Martin. He had the beard and he was a big guy and he had like the George R. R. Martin hat too. And Scott pointed it out. And Scott, who's like a really nice guy, he was just like, dude, come on. Like, you look like George R. R. Martin. Like, you're wearing that hat. Like, what do you expect me to say? You're sitting in the front row. You look like George R. R. Martin. What am I supposed to do? It was really funny. I don't know. It cracked me up. But anyway, I am John Anilio. I write songs and I am a composer. And you can check out my music, johnanilio.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, at John Anilio. And today,
it's anything that can happen. Anything can happen Tuesday.
Yeah, it is just the two of us today. Not because we couldn't get a guest, but because Patrick and I, when we switched to the new format, we said like, yeah, we should do some shows once in a while, just the two of us, because we like talking, you know. So
just the two of us building castles in the sky. No, I can't do that.
Oh, that's a good one. It's a good.
I'll find the clip from Austin Powers and I'll play that one.
This is a very sensitive subject. Yeah. From the moment I heard Frau say I had a clone, I knew that I'd be safe because I'd never be alone. An evil doctor shouldn't speak aloud about his feelings. My hurt and my pain don't make me too appealing. I hope Scott would look up to me, run the business of the family, head an evil empire just like his dear old dad. Give him my love and the things I never had. Scott would think I was a cool guy, return the love I have, make me want to cry. Be evil, but have my feelings too. Change my life with Oprah and Maya Angelou. But Scott rejected me, c'est la vie. Life is cruel, treats you unfairly. Even so, a god there must be, mini me. You complete me.
Just the two of us.
Uh-huh.
We can make it.
Yeah.
If we try. Just two of us.
Yeah. Just me and you. Getting jiggy with it.
Just the two of us.
Yeah.
Woo.
Quite pleasant, really.
Just the two of us.
You and I.
Daddy loves you. Daddy loves you.
Woo!
Just the two of us.
You and I.
Good job. But anyway, so we wanted to do this, and since we kind of switched to the new format, we hadn't done it yet. So when Patrick and I were talking about, oh, who should we get on the show next? Patrick was like, oh, and let's make some time to do one just the two of us. So
let's here have we some are. Me it's time.
A, just some me time. Just some us time. So it is just going to be us today, and we're gonna it's probably gonna be more random than usual.
John, I had dinner last night with two friends, and one of them is going back to school. The other one is actually a school teacher, fourth grade.
Okay.
So I feel you can relate. She is completely and utterly overwhelmed for school to start. It's her first. It's her first.
Okay. Yeah.
Full that class. Is,
okay. That it is quite overwhelming in the beginning. I mean, really, and I will tell you this, I've been teaching for a very long time now. It's really weird. I'm going into my 17th year teaching, and in the same school too, the whole time. This is my first job out of college, and I've just been there longer than I've been any place else in life. So it's really weird that that's a really long time. And I will tell you this, I wasn't comfortable teaching to at least 5 years in. I mean, it took about 5 years to like just not be overwhelmed, because it's especially if you're at the elementary school level where they're so needy. I mean, you have first and second graders, like they can't tie their shoes. They ask to go to the bathroom all the time. It's really difficult. You're a parent as much as you are a teacher to them, and especially if you're younger and you have no experience doing that, it's really challenging. And you're trying to hold on to your job too, because most teachers, I'm not sure how it works from state to state, but in New Jersey, you get tenure after 3 years, although now it might be four. So you hold on to your job pretty easily after that 3 years, but before that 3 years, they can really let you go for no reason or for very little reason. They could just decide like you're not working out. So it's pretty stressful. You get evaluated pretty strenuously, particularly those first few years. So it's overwhelming dealing with the kids, dealing with the evaluations. And so I understand, but once you get into it, I would say I only felt really comfortable about 7-8 years in. Like I was teaching for a long time before I really kind of felt comfortable with it. And it's a hard job. So, but you'll do fine. If you want to do it and you like doing it, you'll figure it out. And really it's like anything else that you do, you can only really get good at it by doing it. So you can be in school and you could study all the theory all you want. Like you just have to be in the classroom and learn how to deal with kids, and you will eventually learn how to deal with them, or you'll quit. And a lot of people quit. A lot of people do quit.
And the jux of the conversation, we were talking about a lot of different things. Number one, she was saying that in the Denver public school system, you can't hang anything from the ceiling.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I remember like stars and we used to do planets and we used to hang those from the ceiling, and you can't do any of that.
No, you can't do it in New Jersey anymore either.
You can't put stuff up on the walls. Your walls can't be more than 50% covered in paper.
There's like a measurement from the ceiling that you can't go.
Yeah,
like
there's
above.
Also. Yeah, she was telling me about the measurement from the ceiling and a measurement from the floor as well. Mm-hmm. That you. Mm-hmm. So there's like all these weird rules that I don't remember. Yes. Of course, you know, it's one of those things. It's like the three horsemen we were talking about last week, the three grumpy old men. It's like. I remember riding my bike without a helmet across highways to go visit my friend, you know, and I would be gone for hours and hours and hours and hours, and my mom would never know where I was. And you can't do that kind of shit anymore. It's just not the world we live in. But it cracks me up, you know, some of the stuff. Mm-hmm. They were putting all the teachers through diversity training.
Mm-hmm.
So they understood, you know, all the diverse cultures and this and that, and you have to be sensitive to this and sensitive to that. And I was like, you know, when you're a kid, you don't know anything about any of that stuff. You just know that you've got friends and you hang out and you play together. And it's not until you become an adult that someone says, well, you need to be aware of diversity. And you need to be aware of there's different cultures and people have different skin colors and there's racism, and you need to be this and this. And you're growing up and you're going, you don't know anything about that. All you know is hanging out and having fun, and everybody is the same, and you've got boys and you've got girls, and you're just kids. It's not until you get an adult that other adults drop all that crap on you.
And I will say this too, from the generation of kids that I've been teaching, and now I've probably taught two generations of kids because I've been here for so long, but and this is particularly something that impacts me because my son, who's 7, is autistic. And when we were kids, you know, the special needs students weren't really integrated with the regular education students very much. And now they are. Now it's and you can make arguments for and against it. But I will tell you this, with the kids that I see in the school that I teach in, and then just seeing the kids at my son's school, they're so much better than we were when we were kids in terms of that, because they've always had the kids who are special needs students as a part of their life and as a part of their school experience. Mm. And they are so open and accepting, and they, you know, there's never any sort of, at least at the elementary school level, that's all I can speak to. Maybe it gets bad when it gets to high school or middle school, but the elementary school kids, they're great. They're just like, oh, this is another kid. He's in my class. Like, he's different than I am, but you know, whatever, he's here, it's cool. Like, and they're always like, it really does kind of, you know, make you swell up a little bit, because you're like, wow, like these, we always say how horrible kids are sometimes, but like, they're not, and not in this case. They're really very sweet and very kind, and they really have the capacity to be really, really wonderful kids. And it's, you know, that's just kind of their nature, because we didn't say like, hey, you got to be nice to these kids, because they just do it because that's what they are. So you're right. So,
it's not until the adults start putting all their crap on them. You know, we suck. We're adults. We suck because we put all this crap on the kids. Anyway, that's my rant for the day.
All right. Well, very good. Well, let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
I will go first. My pick this week is Chuck Klosterman's new book. Chuck Klosterman is my favorite nonfiction writer, one of my favorite nonfiction writers, at least anyway. And his new book is called I Wear the Black Hat. He's written some fiction novels as well, but I've read all of his nonfiction. He's up to about 5 or 6 books now. And this particular book examines villains, and not necessarily fictional villains, but people who have been vilified, whether they're celebrities or, you know, even like Hitler and O.J. Simpson, and just this idea of the villain in our culture. But he writes about it. But Klosterman has a really, his writing style is very free-flowing, and it's very humorous, and he just goes into all these crazy tangents. And he's exactly, I think he's like 41, so he's like very generationally, like just right where I am, likes a lot of the same music, wrote a book called Fargo Rock City, which is all about him growing up in Fargo and being a heavy metal fan, but just like all these like sort of weird things have to do. And he wrote a great book called Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, which is a very like a pop culture book. Really any of his nonfiction stuff I can recommend, and I really enjoy his new one. And, you know, just talks about how it goes on this tangent about how in the movie Purple Rain, we like the villain, who is Morris Day, more than we like Prince's character, because Morris Day is confident, and he's, you know, it's very all over the place. So if that's not to your liking, it may not be a book for you. But I would say, especially if you're generationally, you know, a couple years on either side of 40, and you like music and you like pop culture, and I think you'd really enjoy these books. You just like, you'll just connect two things that are so far away from each other, and you'll be like, yeah, man. Like, he wrote this whole essay, not in this book, but in one of his other ones, about how as a kid you really identify with Luke Skywalker, but then as you get older you identify with Han Solo, but it's all bullshit. We really should have all been staying on with Luke Skywalker, because that, but like, everyone doesn't admit that they, you know, related to Luke Skywalker first. They always want to say they were Han Solo people, but we were really all Luke Skywalker. Anyway, really good. He wrote a whole long essay about Saved by the Bell, and about the show Saved by the Bell, mm-hmm. and how it's but he gets into these like really deep thoughts with it. I love him. So it's Chuck Klosterman. It's Klosterman. All of his nonfiction is great. His new book is I Wear the Black Hat. So you can't go wrong.
Have you seen that in the comics they have now, they're doing an adaptation of George Lucas's original script
for
the Star Wars that never mm-hmm. became anything, and that was mm-hmm. thrown away in order to make the movies?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why?
I don't know. I'm a pretty big Star Wars fan, and I don't really have much of an interest in reading that. But I guess, you know, some people will buy anything that has Star Wars written on it, so why
what
not?
The like, hell?
It's funny, my mom is convinced that she read the Star Wars books before they were movies. No, I read them, John. I know I read them. I'm like, Mom, they weren't books first. Like he had an idea for books and he had treatments and then they wrote books after the fact. But he's like, no, I read the books first. I'm like, and she's convinced to this day, I cannot convince her otherwise. And I'm like, okay. It just was always cracks me up. We always get into this sort of argument. She's like, no, I read them. I'm like, no, you didn't. They didn't exist. It was the movies first. So anyway.
You know what? I'm curious because the original Star Wars book, I wonder what the publication date was. The one that was written supposedly by Lucas. Okay, so according to this, it's 1977. So it came out with the movie.
Yeah.
Edition, May 12th, 1977.
When did the movie come out?
Star Wars movie release date.
It's probably about the same time. I would think it's the same.
I'm trying to figure out. Let's see how good my Google Foo is.
Goofoo?
25 May 1977.
So it's the same.
So the book came out, 13 days before?
All right, well, I guess I really don't think my mom read it in that 13 days. Mom just seems like she read like 5 books in the series or something.
No. I don't think
so. No. But anyway, well, that's it. So what's your pick this week?
I'm struggling to find a pick this week. I tell you what, you know, I had something in mind, and when I went to write it down, I thought, wait, have I already done that? And so then I went through my notes on what we've done the last few weeks and last few episodes, and I was looking through all those, and I didn't see it on there. When I went back to write it down, I couldn't remember what it was.
Well.
Don't you hate that?
I do hate that.
So what I'm going to go with is, I mentioned a couple of episodes back that I took my car to Walmart and got the oil changed.
Mm-hmm.
I bought the first season of Homeland.
Mm-hmm.
I also was able to pick up, I think for $10, the entire Babylon 5 Crusade.
Okay, what is that?
So after Babylon 5, have you ever seen Babylon 5?
I have not.
Okay, so the series closes with something diabolical happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes the genesis for a new series called Babylon 5 Crusade, where essentially something really bad happens to Earth, and there is one ship out there that no one from there has anything to do with what happened, and they are now on a quest to find a way to reverse what happened to Earth.
Okay.
I'm being vague on purpose. Yeah. If you haven't seen it, I don't want to be spoilery. So the premise of the show was that, you know, this ship is out there and they're going to go out and find a way to reverse what happened. And it's Gary Cole. I don't know if you remember Gary Cole.
Yeah.
He's a great actor. He's been on all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. They also had a techno mage on board. Cool. And it was just this, it was a different kind of show, and it was a spinoff that TNT was hoping would take off, and it never did.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in on Saturday, and then I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in on Sunday as well. That's Gary Cole, right?
Yes, it is. And wasn't he also Mike Brady in the Brady Bunch?
Yes.
Movies?
Yes. I love Gary
and
Cole.
And he was the Night Stalker. The night something or other. He had a show where he was the radio host who he'd be on the overnight radio, and there'd be some crime going on, and so he would go solve the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
he's good and everything.
He was on a recent episode of Suits on USA where he was playing the main Suits guy's like mentor at the DA's office, and they did a flashback 10 years, and somehow they worked the Night Stalker into the conversation, which I thought was kind of clever.
Cool.
For fan, cool. fans of Gary Cole.
And there are many out there. So, all right. Well, let's get on to our main topic this week. And our main topic is going to be based on a blog post email that I wrote. I was saying in the last episode that I've been doing these weekly email / blogs that I send out. And one of my recent ones was, should you do it by yourself? Or should you do it alone? Meaning,
hi-yo!
I write half of these titles for these blog posts, and then I'm just like, well, what sort of sexual innuendo can you read into this? And sometimes
I can always read something into it.
Yeah.
I can always.
So,
always.
And a lot of some of what inspired this particular blog post was watching the Sound City documentary, which was my pick a few episodes back. And Mick Fleetwood, Dave Grohl, who did that documentary, was interviewing Mick Fleetwood. And he was talking about, you know, what eventually closes down, or one of the things that contribute to Sound City closing down, is the advent of digital home recording, and about how you can do all of this at home, by yourself even. That's how I make my music. It's all done on my laptop, and it's all done by myself. And Mick Fleetwood, when he and Dave Grohl were talking about this, said, the danger is that people think that you can do it by yourself now, and you can do it by yourself, but
they have attachments.
Well, he's like, but I guarantee you that you'll be a much happier human being if you do it with other human beings. So that really struck me, because as I've been sort of really on a bit of a soul searching thing lately, which is what a lot of these blog posts are about what I'm doing creatively and artistically and how I want to go about doing things. And, you know, my whole I quit post, and we talked about that with Chris Holm a few weeks ago. One of the reasons why the things that contribute to me being unhappy being creative is that I am doing it all by myself. Not only are, you know, do I write everything by myself. I mean, I've done some co-writes with people, and lyrically, a couple of people have contributed some lyrics in the past, but really I've written everything and I've recorded everything myself. Like every note you hear on my recordings, with the exception of a couple of saxophone solos that my friend laid down, is me. Every drum beat, every note, every guitar riff, every bass line, every keyboard, every vocal, it's all me. And I loved that for a long time. But when you're recording it all, and you're arranging it all, and you're editing it all, and you're mixing it all, and you're mastering it, like, it's overwhelming. And you get stuck in your own head, and it quickly isn't so fun anymore. And I think that really contributed to a lot of my unhappiness doing it, was that I really sucked a lot of the fun out of it, because it was so much work and so much tedious work. So I just posed the question to people, should you do it alone? And I think there are certainly pros and cons to doing it by yourself. And, you know, there's actual creative collaboration where, you know, whether you're a writer, maybe whether you're co-writing, or a lot of bands, you know, they get in a room and they start writing together, or there's people where they write it themselves, but then they bring in other people to help with other parts of the process. So, I think there are just a lot of ways to look at it, and depending on what you're looking for, sometimes it's advantageous to do most of it by yourself, and sometimes it's not. So, Patrick, you coming from a writer's point of view on it, now I know you write everything by yourself. You're not, you don't really do co-writes, but there are certainly, from the time that you're writing it to the time that it gets out into the world, other people can, there are certainly a lot of other jobs that need to be done, which in the past, there was no such thing really as self-publishing, and that's what the publisher did. The publisher would edit and take care of the artwork and take care of the distribution. Now you can do that all by yourself, but should you do it by yourself? And so what are your thoughts on that as a writer?
Well, first off, I mean, everything you're saying is contrary to all of the Japanese sex bot marketing I see on Facebook. So they say you can do it by yourself. Yeah, I'm flashing to Archer. I don't know why, but so it's there's lots of stuff there. I mean, there was self-publishing. There's always been self-publishing. I mean, there are labels, and a lot of times we put labels on things because we want, you know, we put our labels on stuff. It's like we were talking about with the kids, and you know, the kids are just kids, and they just have friends, and they just have fun, and they play together. And then we as adults put labels on everything, and we teach the kids, no, there's a label for this, and there's, you know, everything in its neat little row. And that kind of happened. Self-publishing was labeled vanity publishing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you're being vain. You're not doing it the right way. You're not going through the gatekeepers and traditional publishing. You're self-publishing as a vanity thing, and you're paying for it all, and you're doing all the work yourself. And therefore, you know, we can dismiss you. We, whoever we are as professionals, blah, 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 blah. We can dismiss the self-published author. You know, because self-publishing is a danger to traditional publishing in that, you know, if it ever really became and took off, it could eat into the market and erode the profits and all that kind of stuff. Because as we talked about before, when you look at publishing, you have publishers are in it because it's a business and they're there to make money, and it's they've got to make a profit. And anything that threatens that profit is obviously a problem. So self-publishing was vanity publishing, and over the last 13 years or so, you know, as we went into the new millennium and things started changing, just like in the music industry, when you started getting more tools at your fingertips to do stuff yourself, people started to explore and try to do other things. So you have folks like Mike Resnick, who has this gigantic back catalog of books that are out of print and that he owns the rights to. And so Mike being Mike, he goes out and quote unquote gets a guy and says, I want to release this now. And the guy formats it. And, you know, Mike doesn't have to do anything except go on Facebook and say, I've released a new book, you know, go buy it. And so, you know, he's self-publishing, but they're not calling it self-publishing now. Now it's indie publishing, because the self-publishers have taken over the conversation, and they're now guiding the narrative, and they're now saying, you know, it's not a vanity press, it's indie publishing. And so, but when you go that route, it's like you said, you now have to wear all the different hats. You have to do a book cover. You have to do the layout. You have to do the copy editing. You have to do the regular editing. You have to look at your work for continuity errors, you know, and make sure that you haven't screwed anything up there. You've got to do all this stuff. And then you also have to do the marketing. Right. If you're gonna go down this route. Now, there are some folks who do things like Kickstarters, and as part of their Kickstarter, they include, I'm going to have X amount of money to hire an artist to do my cover. And I'm gonna have X amount of money to hire an editor to make a pass at the book. And depending on their level of ability with the technology and actually laying out and doing typesetting and stuff like that, they may also have a chunk of that Kickstarter set aside to actually get someone who knows InDesign to lay their book out for them. You know, and it all depends on if they're going electric or publishing. So there are folks who do it themselves. You know, the stuff that I've been pushing out, I've done it all myself. I do it in Scrivener. I use Scrivener's tools to create the ebook, but I'm not laying out a print book. If I was, I would be jumping into InDesign and doing that. But I haven't done the print side of it. I haven't like done Lulu or CreateSpace. I've only done the ebook side. And it's funny because you talk about doing the covers and stuff like that. People say, well, I can tell a self-published book by its cover. And I've asked different folks, well, what do you mean by that? You know, what is making it stand out? Well, you can tell it's just layers in Photoshop. Okay. So, you know, it's not like someone actually, like an artist, like a John Picasso or someone like that, sitting down and actually drawing everything out and doing it. the music side of it, like you're talking about, you know, having different people play the instruments, what you bring to that is someone may think of something that you never did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy who did the saxophone may do a riff that you never thought of doing, but it works perfectly with the song. Mm-hmm. The same thing could be true with if you involve other people in your story that you've written. Like, let's say you involve an editor and the editor says, well, this is really well written and there's lots of good stuff here. However, I don't know if you realized that you had these three things that you left hanging.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, you may have a cover artist who brings to life something. I mean, there's goods and bads. You could also, you know, have these folks commit to stuff, and then now you're relying on them to come back to mm-hmm. you. So,
well, yeah. Well, what I was going to say is, totally. No, I that all makes sense to me. And one of the things that led me to doing everything by myself, and I've been doing it all by myself for quite a long time, even prior to the sci-fi songs, I was doing it all by myself too. Because I found working with bands, as much as I loved playing with bands, I found dealing with bands to not be so great. And anytime you bring someone else into a project,
everyone has an ego.
Well, that too, certainly. But now, it slowed the process down, or at least that was my perspective on it. So I did a CD under my real legal name pre-sci-fi songs about 5 years before that or so. And I had all those songs ready to go, and I was working with a bass player and a drummer at the time, and we would play gigs, and we were playing coffee. I was playing some coffee shop gigs by myself, and we were doing some bar gigs as a band, and we were all excited about going and recording. And the bass player was pretty good. The drummer, who was a guy I played with before, who I think is an amazing drummer, just slowed the process down so much because he wanted to do certain things a certain way, and he wanted to have certain input, and, oh, I'm not available this weekend, or I can't do this. And I just got really frustrated to the point where I was like, and there was other issues in that band. There were some weird personal issues too, but it eventually got to the point where it's like, I'm going to do it by myself. Like, I don't want to deal with you anymore because I wanted to put this album out a year ago and we haven't even started it yet. And I did. And I was very happy with the way that record came out. And I've been doing everything by myself since then.
Well, just riffing off what you just said slightly, mm-hmm. my older brother plays guitar and he plays mm-hmm. bass and he plays piano and he plays drums. And mm-hmm. When we moved to California, he and our cousin formed a band. And our other cousin is a singer. She's really wonderful as a singer. She was going to be the singer for the band. And they just formed this band. They got themselves, you know, so they had two guitar players, my brother and my cousin. They had a bass player. They had a drummer. They had a singer. They had, you know, the whole components for having a decent band. And they spent the next few years practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they were practicing is because my cousin is a perfectionist.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be playing a song, and if the bass player hit the wrong note, he throws his hands up and stops. We got to stop. Mm-hmm. We got to start over. You screwed it mm-hmm. up. And so when you talk about people slowing down the process, mm-hmm. you know, that was a problem because, yeah. you know, his whole thing was, if you could not do it perfectly every single time, we're never playing live. We're never, because I'm not going to deal with the embarrassment of the person in the crowd who can't fucking hear that player dropped a note, yeah. you know, but in his mind, they're going to know that.
Yeah. Well, there's that. And I've been in bands with guys like that, where we practiced for a year before we did a gig. And I don't think it's a bad idea to practice a long time before you gig, but at some point, two, three, 4 years,
it's ridiculous. Yeah,
at some point there is a, you know, trial by fire where you get better by doing gigs. And trust me, no one's paying attention at most gigs that you're playing, especially if you're playing in bars. Like, just as long as, like, you're not singing out of tune and screwing up royally, you get good by doing gigs. Like, that's your 10,000 hours. You got to go play those gigs and you got to make your mistakes and you got to screw up. And like, that's part of the process. So there's that, but there's also the sort of creative direction. Like, I would, sometimes you're really simpatico with people and either they play exactly what you were thinking or they play something totally different, but it's awesome and you like it anyway, or they just start playing something. And you're like, that is not gelling with this at all. And they can get really stuck and they're like, well, no, that's the drum part I'm playing. And that's it. So like, you're like, well, I guess we're not going to do that song. Like, we would not do certain songs. It would just be like, I don't know. And that's another thing too. Sometimes, especially if you get into maybe, and it's not necessarily creative, but if you do like a cover band or something, like I would be in cover bands with guys and I'd want to do certain covers and they would just be like, oh no, I'm not doing that. That's lame. I'm not, there's a lot of like, that's lame. And it's like, but we'll kill on that song. We'll kill that song and people will love it. That's lame. I'm not doing it. So it's like, other people will slow the process down. Even if you get along great, from that regard, it slows it down. But
well, there's a trade-off.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was just going to say. I was going to say that, like, but yeah, but you're forgetting what they add, though.
Right.
Like, you're adding that, like, oh, now I don't have a drummer to play, so I got to program every note that a drummer would play, and it's not going to sound as good. So, yeah, it's there. There is you do trade it off, and what are the trade-offs for you then, doing it by yourself or asking other people for help?
You mean as far as a like a publishing,
a book,
writing?
Yeah.
Well, so writing is a little bit different, obviously, than music. When you're writing, it's 90% of it is a very solitary act. Yes, you have people who collaborate, but you know, most authors, you're out there and it's a solitary thing. They're doing it all on their own. You know, mm-hmm. and it can be very, very easy to only do that and stay in your own head and not ever involve other people.
Mm-hmm.
And really, those are the folks who never try to get published. And those are a little bit also the folks that like Publish America preys on, you know, because you do still have the scam kind of self-publishing, like Publish America. Mm-hmm. And I know someone who is in my family, is a relative, and I was sent this person's novel by their grandmother, who said, you're the only person I know who knows anything about writing and publishing and this kind of stuff. My granddaughter has this book, and someone is going to publish it, but they want her to give them money. And I don't understand, you know, this, and would you please take a look at this? And I'm like, sure. So it's horrible. You know, it's definitely a book that has never seen the light of day and no one else has ever read it or offered any feedback on. And it's a Publish America kind of thing. You know, they're like, hey, if you give us X amount of dollars, we'll publish it. Sure, it's great. You know, we'll get you all the stuff you want, you know, and I wrote this very long email back to them basically explaining all that and how Publish America works. And I just saw on Facebook that they went through with it anyway.
Oh, wow.
You know, because they're being published. They're being published. And it's not. So you can definitely fall into that trap of staying in your own head and never letting anybody see it. That's why I'm so big on if you're an author and if you're serious and if you truly want to go forward, find yourself a writer's group. And there's online writers groups. Murr always talks about these on I Should Be Writing. There's always local groups. Local groups are great because then you can actually sit across from someone and have a discussion about your stuff. You have to get another set of eyes on it no matter what. And they can't be your family. They cannot be your family because your family loves you. You know, they have to. They're obligated genetically.
Or hates you.
Yeah, and again, they're obligated.
It could be the other extreme too. Yeah,
but they'll tell you what you want to hear, not what you need to hear. Mm-hmm. So you have to get other people involved, whether it's actually collaboration or not. You know, I mean, you take it to the writers group, you have them read it, you have them tell you what works, what doesn't work, and then you take that back and you soak it in and you try to be better. Now, when you actually get to the point where you want to start pushing stuff out, I have pushed some stuff out. You've seen that. Mm-hmm. I've done some short story stuff that I've pushed out. I've done the covers myself. I've done all the layout and everything in Scrivener, and produced the eBooks. And you have to wear all those hats. There's another author that I'm friends with, and he lives here in Denver now, and he recently published, you know, pushed out his own book using the IndiePub model, and he was exhausted when I met him. You know, we kind of met and chatted for a little bit. He was exhausted. I'm like, what's going on? He's like, well, you know, it's just launching a book. You know, I'm doing it all. I'm the publicist. I'm the marketing guy. I'm the cover guy. I'm the design guy. I'm the layout guy. I'm the editor. You know, he's like, I do have an editor that I work with, but then it still falls on me. And you know, he does it all. And there are people who want that level of control. And one of the lures of doing the IndiePub, self-pub / do-it-yourself model is the royalty split. You know, if you're going to go Amazon, you can get 70%, you know, based on the price of the book. And that's very appealing. The difference is, you know, going traditional publishing, getting that advance. Do you want that advance? And it is an advance on royalties. If your book never makes any money, you're not going to see another dime. But it is nice to get, you know, that $10,000-$15,000 check, depending on your contract and what you've done, and saying, "My gosh, I'm an author, I'm a writer, I've got a check in my hand. Look at me." You know, there's definitely that, and it, you know, it's like we talk about the Hugos. It's great to be nominated. It's an honor to be nominated, but boy, wouldn't it be cool to win? You know, you've won.
Well, and I think what particularly with publishing. Because I think with the advance and from authors that we've spoken to within genre, the advance is not very much.
No,
for most. And I was about to make a point.
Anywhere from 3 to 15, depending on the publisher.
And the point that I was going to make, but and I'll make that point in a moment. But I think what publishers bring is getting you in bookstores, which as an indie, physically, you really can't get your books in a Barnes & Noble or an airport or anything like that. I guess it could be done, but I don't know anybody that does that. So that's a huge chunk of the book buying public that's probably never going to see your book. But in terms of advances, especially if it's someone like yourself, who you have a platform. And we've often talked about platform, and your platform being the multitude of things that you do. This podcast, SF Signal, your Twitter, your Facebook, your website, your blog, you're writing for Kirkus, you're writing for SF Signal. You have a platform. You could, and we've talked about it in private, like you could do a Kickstarter now for your novel or one of your novels, and you could probably get what an advance is at this point from a Kickstarter. I bet you could. And like that's a discussion that we can have in private to talk about. And I didn't mean to put you on the spot. But
Before you go off on that, let's talk about the Kickstarter for a second. The other thing that we've talked about off air, and we may have talked about it on air, is that that's a possibility. I don't want to burn that bridge down on a project unless I'm serious about it. You know, I don't want to, the people who listen to the podcasts and who follow me on Twitter and who, you know, I don't get very serious very often. I purposely don't, because I'm trying to entertain people. And, you know, I don't want to be serious all the time. I prefer to make
people laugh. You're hiding the pain.
No, I prefer to make people laugh. That's just my style. Yeah. All of these folks I care deeply about. They're wonderful people because they are paying attention, and I don't want to shortchange them. So if I'm going to go down that road and do a Kickstarter, I'm going to make it a meaningful Kickstarter, and I'm going to have everything in place so that I can properly reward them for their faith in me.
So the point that I was making with you is that If you were at the point where you felt really good about your novel and you felt like you set up you know, because we were talking about, like, with the Kickstarter, like, a lot of people that do, for authors, for instance, you know, part of the Kickstarter is usually like, oh, and if the Kickstarter goes through, then I have this person lined up to do the artwork, and I have right. this person lined up mm-hmm. to do the editing, and I have this person lined up. So you got it all going, and I think at this point, someone like yourself has a big enough platform and have these people that are friends, because you and I have talked about this before too. I hate when people start talking about their fans, and it's like, you don't say that, you know, unless you're Neil Gaiman or somebody, or just some whoever, whether you're a musician or a writer, we're friends, okay? Or we're, you know, we hang out on, like, I don't like that, but anyway, but you have your friends online and you have a lot of them. And I bet a lot of them would be very willing to back a Kickstarter that you did. And if you put the project together in such a way where you knew it was going to be high quality and you presented it and did all the right things and really delivered on that, I think you could, and depending on what you asked for too, because I think some people ask for too much.
Right. And we've talked about that offline before. Yep.
Yeah. And I've seen, you know, and I know a lot of people listening to this have run Kickstarters, and I don't want to offend anybody who does, because, like, a lot of people I know have run successful Kickstarters, and a lot of people have run unsuccessful Kickstarters, and possibly this is me and Patrick just being very insecure as human beings, because but I see people run, and I've had people email me and Twitter me and being like, hey, how can I get people to back my Kickstarter? And I'll look at it, and it looks fine, and it looks like a good idea. But I'm like, well, you have 40 Twitter followers. Like, I don't.
And you're asking for $25,000.
Well, yeah. Even if it was, I'm thinking of a particular example, and it was a lot less than that. And the project looked cool, and the guy was really nice. But I think that's, like, really, you know, the thing that I wrote back to him was, it looks cool. I'm like, really, I can't give you any advice on this, because I'll give you the advice that Seth Godin, who's a marketer who I read his blog all the time, gives, is that you have to start establishing those relationships years before you ask for anything. Mm-hmm. You can't just suddenly ask. People don't know you. Like, people, because I said, I'm like, people don't know who you are. You know, you can't just ask, like, Will Wheaton to tweet a link to your Kickstarter. He doesn't know who you are. You know,
well,
so
$50, but
so it's like, no, but it's like, I think other people, and the people that I've seen run successful Kickstarters, they're very involved in the community. They're not me. They're good. Like, they're a good writer or a good musician or whatever, and they've proven consistently that they put out good product, whether it's novels or blogs or podcasts or what have you. They've sort of said, like, yeah, I can do this. They've proven by their track record, and they've proven themselves to be a good part of a community, and so people will back it. But I think you and if I was going to do one day, if you asked for the right amount, I think it could be done. But you're right. It's like, yeah, but then you spend all of that goodwill. Mm-hmm. You spend it all. So do you want to spend it on this? You know, like, that's what it comes down to.
Well, and your good drinking buddy is a good example of this, Mr. Peter V. Brett.
Yes. Yeah.
Hold on one second. Yes, your good drinking buddy, Mr. Peter V. Brett, is a good example of what I kind of want to convey here. He's very obsessive about his first draft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his first draft has to be tight and concise. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not going to let his editor see it until he's ready. You know, and he feels confident in it. And I tend to be the same way on my first drafts.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I do take my first drafts to the writers groups, I have had in the past people go, "This is the first draft, you fucker."
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, it's good. You know, it's mm-hmm. there's not a lot of weirdness in there. And it's that kind of obsessiveness, and maybe it's obsessive compulsiveness, that makes me not want to do a Kickstarter unless it's really, really good.
Well, I think Kickstarter works best if it's a really special project.
Well, you know, I guess where I'm coming from is I don't want to end up in the list of projects that Fred Kish has backed that have either failed or funded and then failed, and he's never going to see anything for his money. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, that obviously. But I mean, I think even, you know, beyond that, it makes the most sense to just, I think it's at a point where the crowdfunding thing is sort of leveling out now, because probably enough people have run unsuccessful ones. But I still do see people running them that maybe it's not the best time to run it. And I think it does get down to also, I don't know if that's a... I am still here.
yeah, that's what happened to me. Mine popped up and did the same damn thing.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a... I don't know. Who knows? Maybe that's going to be the way it's going to work for independent creators, where they're just going to keep using Kickstarter. And we have some friends that have run a lot of Kickstarters, successful ones.
Forbeck.
Yeah, Forbeck does them. I don't feel like he's done one in a while, but he did a bunch right in a row, and were all successful. And Bradley Bollier did a bunch, and they were all successful.
Check you out pronouncing his name correctly.
I know. Well, he gave me the best way to figure it out. Bowl your ass off, man. I'll never forget it. So those guys have run successful ones. Now, are they going to do it forever? I don't know. They're a mix. They get traditionally published. They do their indie publishing and all that.
You know when the best time probably is to launch a Kickstarter?
When's that?
After you've won a Hugo.
Probably. So... hopefully, when this is airing, you'll have won a Hugo. And then Patrick, our next episode that you'll hear, Patrick will be announcing a Kickstarter. Fund my Kickstarter, bitches. Hugo nominated. Podcaster and author. well, I think that might be like a good place to start wrapping it up there. But I think there's... It really comes down to, and I'm sure there's an ebb and a flow, and there are times when you really want to work with people, and there are times where you want to do things by yourself. And I know for me personally, I'm kind of getting to a point where I'm trying to figure out, I don't want to do it all by myself anymore, but what do I want to do with other people? How am I going to be able to work with other people again, where it's going to be enjoyable and meaningful and not slow the process down? And get me back to why I do this in the first place is because I really like doing it. I want to get back to really enjoying doing it. So that's where I'm at with it. And Patrick, thanks for talking about this. I think we understand each other a little better now. I learned something today. Well,
the more
anyway.
You know.
So once again, for me, John Anilio, johnanilio.com, at John Anilio on Twitter. Patrick is ATFMB, at ATFMB, ATFMB.com and at ATFMB on Twitter. And, hopefully Patrick has won a Hugo by now. anything else you want to say, Patrick, before we wrap it up?
I did want to say that Mile High Con is coming up, and I am planning to be at Mile High Con. I don't know if I'm going to be on any of the programming yet. I have asked I just can't say that word, to be on the programming, and I have not heard yet from them. But I will be at Mile High Con, so if anybody is in the Denver area and planning on going to Mile High Con, Shauna McGuire is the guest of honor this year. You guys ought to come and check her out. She is utterly awesome, unless, of course, the SF Squeakcast beat me again, in which case I don't give a shit.
Slightly less awesome, yeah.
Slightly less awesome. And if the Squeakcast beat me again, do not come see Shauna McGuire. Come see Mira Grant.
Yes. All right. I know that's her. That's one of her pen names. Inside
right. Baseball.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here?
It's over. Go home. Go.